ever walked out of a salon and just feeling like, oh no.
Oh yeah.
Like a haircut gone wrong or
a color that just did not hit the mark.
Not quite right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, imagine that, but like 100 times worse and you end up with actual injuries.
Oh wow.
That's what happened in the case we're diving into today. Dutrevine Ake.
Okay.
This case, it's from 1965.
All right.
And it's straight out of Michigan.
Interesting.
Throws a spotlight on beauty shop blunders.
Yeah.
For sure. But it actually gets even more interesting than that.
Okay.
We're talking about like industry standards
mm-hmm.
and like this really kind of crazy legal thing that had the courts debating, like, can you really separate like the whodunit part of a case from the how bad was it part of a case?
Well, and what makes Dutrevine Ake so interesting is it really kind of goes beyond just like basic negligence.
Yeah.
It sparked a debate about a procedural move.
Okay.
That has implications for really all sorts of legal cases. So that question of can you separate liability? So did somebody do something wrong from the question of damages?
Right.
How much harm was caused?
Okay. So let's unpack this a little bit. So he's got Mrs. Dutry.
Okay.
Goes to the beauty shop for like a bleach and color treatment.
Oh.
Or, you know, walk out like looking fabulous.
Of course.
Instead, she ends up with injuries to her head and face.
Oh my goodness.
And the thing is that no patch test was done before the treatment.
Okay.
So that immediately kind of throws up a red flag for me.
Sure.
Was that a standard practice back then? I mean, was this beauty shop cutting corners or was this just how things were done?
Well, and that's a really crucial piece of the puzzle here is that missing patch test.
Right.
So to figure out if the beauty shop was actually negligent,
right,
we have to understand what the average beautician would have done.
In 1965.
In a similar situation back in 1965, exactly.
Wow.
And that's where this idea of industry standards comes into play. Okay, so it's not just about like what happened to her.
Right.
But what was considered acceptable practice.
Exactly.
In the beauty industry.
In the beauty industry at that time.
At that time.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what makes this case so interesting.
Yeah.
It forces us to think about how we determine negligence.
Yeah.
Especially in fields where professional standards are constantly evolving.
Yeah, like even like from year to year. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Things change.
Absolutely.
Right? And then to add another layer to all of this,
okay,
a jury initially awarded her $10,000 in damages.
Wow.
I mean, case closed, right?
You would think, right?
Wrong.
Nope.
The beauty shop owners, they weren't satisfied.
Well.
And so they decided to fight back.
They did.
So they filed a motion for a new trial.
Okay.
Which, you know, is not unusual.
Right, right.
But here's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
The trial court agreed to a new trial, but only on the question of liability.
So basically, they wanted to retry whether the beauty shop was at fault, just assuming that the damages were already settled.
Interesting.
Hold on, a partial retrial?
Yeah.
That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, yeah.
Why would a court only retry part of the case?
Well, that's where this concept of bifurcation comes in.
Bifurcation.
Bifurcation, yeah. It's kind of like splitting the baby, legally speaking.
Okay.
It's the idea of separating that question of liability, like did they do something wrong?
Right.
From that question of damages, how much harm was caused?
Right.
And Dutrevine Ake became a landmark case because it sparked this legal debate about whether the separation is actually fair.
Okay, so we've got a potential breach of standards,
mm-hmm.
a big chunk of change awarded.
Right.
And then this whole partial retrial curveball.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're dealing with a legal puzzle here.
Absolutely we are. And, you know, one of the key pieces of this puzzle was missing from that original trial.
What's that?
Testimony about what was considered standard practice.
Right. For patch tests in Flint's beauty industry at the time.
Okay.
And this wasn't just like some minor detail.
Yeah.
This was crucial evidence.
Right.
That could have helped the jury decide if the beauty shop was truly negligent.
It's like trying to judge a chef's cooking without knowing what ingredients were available, you know,
exactly.
Or what techniques were common.
Exactly. You need that context.
Back in the day.
You need that context.
Yeah.
And the Michigan Court of Appeals, they picked up on this missing piece too.
Okay.
In their decision, they said, and I quote, "No one is held to a higher standard of care than the average in the industry."
Mm.
And this really underscores the importance of those expert witnesses.
Right.
In cases like this.
They can say, like, this is how it was.
They can help establish what those generally accepted practices are.
Yeah.
Within a specific field.
Right.
Provide that context that the jury needs to make a fair judgment.
So the trial court excluded this testimony about industry standards.
Right, which then made it hard for the jury to decide if the beauty shop was actually negligent.
Exactly.
And then on top of that, we've got this whole separate debate about whether you can even split a case in two.
Mm-hmm.
Like that separating liability from damages.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is a lot to think about.
To wrap our heads around.
A lot to wrap our heads around. And so the Michigan Court of Appeals, they really wrestled with that question of bifurcation.
Yeah.
Can you or should you separate those two issues?
Right.
Is it fair to judge someone's actions without knowing the full extent of the consequences?
It seems like those two things are kind of interconnected. Like you can't really talk about one without considering the other.
That's exactly what the Court of Appeals found.
Okay.
They argued that, especially in personal injury cases like this one,
right,
the extent of the injury
yeah.
is often inseparable from how the injury happened.
Okay.
Imagine a jury hearing about a car accident.
Okay.
Wouldn't their judgment of the driver's negligence be different if they knew the accident resulted in a fatality versus just a fender bender?
Completely different.
Right.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
Knowing how bad the outcome was
yeah.
can definitely influence how you judge someone's actions.
It can color your perception for sure.
Even if the actions themselves were the same.
Exactly. And the Court of Appeals, they drove this point home in their decision.
Okay.
They said, and I'm quoting here, the jury determining liability should also measure damages.
Wow.
So they're basically saying that you can't really judge the what without understanding the how much.
Right. And that's a really powerful statement.
It is. It is. That statement, it really gets to like the heart of the issue, you know?
Yeah.
It suggests that separating liability and damages can lead to like an incomplete picture of what happened.
Right.
And that could impact, you know, the fairness of the outcome.
Right. But isn't there another side to this though?
Oh, sure.
Don't some people argue that separating liability and damages can actually make things more efficient?
Oh, absolutely. There are arguments in favor of bifurcation, for sure.
Yeah.
Efficiency is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Imagine like a complicated case.
Okay.
Where just proving the liability could involve weeks or even months of testimony.
Cool. Oh, wow.
Mountains of evidence.
Yeah.
And then if the jury decides there's no liability, then all that time and money spent arguing about damages would be totally pointless.
Yeah, it's like, why even bother calculating the cost of the repairs if you haven't even figured out if the mechanic actually messed up the car in the first place?
Precisely.
Yeah.
And sometimes separating those issues can make it easier for the jury, too.
Okay.
It allows them to focus on each question independently
uh-huh.
without being swayed by, like, you know, emotional details about the damages.
Right.
So it's kind of like separating the logic
yeah.
from the emotion.
Right.
Which can be helpful in reaching a fair verdict.
So there are some valid reasons why a court might choose to bifurcate a trial.
Oh.
But it sounds like in Dutre v. Neack, the Michigan Court of Appeals wasn't really convinced.
Yeah, they weren't buying it.
They seemed pretty firm in their belief that you can't separate
right.
those two issues.
Right.
Especially in a personal injury case.
Especially in personal injury.
Okay.
Yeah, and they argued that in these types of cases, the extent of the injury
mm-hmm.
is often like a key factor in determining how the injury actually happened.
Okay.
So think about a medical malpractice case.
Yeah, okay.
A doctor's actions might seem less negligent if the patient makes like a full recovery.
Yeah.
But if the patient suffers permanent damage, the same actions could be viewed way more harshly.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
It's almost like knowing the consequences.
Right.
Changes your perception of the actions.
Exactly. And that's why the court felt that it was so essential to present the jury with that complete picture.
Okay.
Both the liability and the damages.
Okay.
To ensure a fair and just outcome.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that the jury had all of the information that they needed to make an informed decision.
Not a fragmented one.
Not just a piece of it. Right.
Right. So while there might be some like practical reasons
yeah.
to bifurcate,
sure.
the Michigan Court of Appeals seemed to prioritize the idea of fairness above all else.
Fairness was key for them.
Okay.
And, you know, remember that quote from their decision?
Yeah, the jury determined.
A jury determining liability should also measure damages.
Right.
It's like a clear message that they view those two aspects as connected.
Totally.
Especially in cases where someone's been hurt.
Okay, so Dr. Viniak, it might have been about this beauty shop blunder,
mm-hmm.
but it's given us a lot to think about.
It really has.
When it comes to how legal cases are structured.
Absolutely.
And it really shows how these like technical procedural issues like bifurcation
Yes.
can have such a big impact on fairness and justice
A huge impact.
in the legal system.
For sure. And that's why it's so important for lawyers to be aware of these nuances
Right.
and to advocate for their clients effectively.
Yeah.
Because understanding how those procedural choices can really impact the outcome of a case is crucial.
For achieving justice.
It is.
So let's kind of shift gears for a minute and
Oh,
talk
yeah.
about like the practical implications of this case.
Right.
For lawyers today, like what are some key takeaways that they can learn from Dutre v. Nick?
Well, I think first and foremost, this case really just emphasizes
Yeah.
the importance of industry standards when it
Right.
comes to proving or disproving negligence.
Yeah.
So if you are building a negligence case,
Yeah.
you need to clearly establish what the accepted practices were
Right.
in that field at the time
At the time.
that the incident occurred.
Right.
You need to be able to show that the defendant's actions fell below that standard of care.
So in Mrs. Dutre's case, her lawyer would have needed to bring in some expert witnesses to
Exactly.
testify about how common patch tests were
Right back in the 1960s.
in the beauty industry.
Exactly,
That's
exactly.
blunt.
And on the flip side,
Yeah.
the beauty shop's lawyer, they would have wanted to present evidence
Right.
that suggested that patch tests weren't as common
Right.
or as strictly followed
Right.
as Mrs. Dutre claimed.
As she was saying.
Right, so it becomes this battle of establishing what the norm was,
Right.
and expert testimony is critical for that.
And what about this bifurcation issue?
Yes.
What should lawyers keep in mind when they're facing a possible partial retrial?
Well, Dutre v. Nia shows us that Michigan courts, they're pretty skeptical of
Demo.
separating liability from damages,
Okay.
especially in personal injury cases.
Okay.
So if you're practicing in a jurisdiction
Yeah.
that follows similar precedents,
Yeah.
you're going to need really strong arguments to
Yeah.
convince that court that bifurcation is appropriate.
Right. You can't just assume that they'll go for
You
it.
can't just assume.
Yeah.
You need to show that those issues of liability and damages are truly distinct,
Okay.
and that separating them won't unfairly disadvantage either party. And you need to be prepared for some pushback from that court.
So it's not impossible
Not
to get
impossible.
a partial retrial.
It's not impossible, but you just have to have a really good reason.
You better have a good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like the legal system is saying, hey, let's not cut corners here.
Right.
Let's give the jury all the
Oh,
information
all the info.
that they
Ever?
need to make a fair decision, even if it takes a little bit longer.
Even if it takes a little longer.
So Dutre v. Nieck, a case from the past,
Yeah.
offers some really valuable lessons
Yes.
for legal professionals today.
Absolutely.
Understanding the nuances of industry standards, navigating these complex procedures like bifurcation,
Yeah.
and recognizing that interconnectedness
Yeah.
of liability and damages. These are
Yes.
all key takeaways that can inform and shape how we approach negligence cases even today.
Couldn't agree more.
This case, with this like beauty shop backdrop,
Yeah.
it highlights principles that reach far beyond the salon chair.
Oh, absolutely.
Well said.
Thank you.
But before we wrap up our deep dive into Dutre v. Nieck,
Okay.
there's one more fascinating angle I want to explore.
All right, I'm listening.
It's something that wasn't directly addressed in the case,
Okay.
but it's something that's been kind of swirling in my mind as we've
Well,
been talking.
okay. I'm intrigued. What is it?
I'm curious about the role of informed consent in these cases.
Oh, interesting.
We know Mrs. Dutre went to the beauty shop
Right.
for a specific treatment,
Yeah.
but did she fully understand the potential risks involved?
That's a good question.
Did she have enough information to make a really informed decision
Yeah.
about whether or not to go ahead with the treatment?
Especially without a patch test.
Especially without a patch test.
Yeah.
And this case predates
Right.
a lot of these consumer protection laws
Of course.
that we have today.
Right.
But it really raises questions about the duty of care that beauty professionals owe to their clients.
It makes you wonder if there should be like a more standardized process
Yeah.
for informing clients about the potential risks
Totally.
of various beauty treatments,
Yeah.
maybe even requiring written consent forms.
Right, because we are talking about like potentially harmful
Yes.
chemicals and procedures here.
Potentially.
Yes, a great question.
Yeah.
And it's something that definitely
Or
deserves
the exploration for sure.
further exploration. And while Dutre v. Nieck focused on those industry standards
Huh?
and the separation of liability and damages.
Right.
It indirectly touches on this broader issue.
Absolutely.
Of informed consent and consumer protection.
It does.
It makes you think about, like, the responsibility of the businesses.
Yeah.
To make sure their clients are fully aware of the potential risks
right.
involved in any serving that they provide.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder
yes.
that legal cases, they often have these ripple effects,
oh,
like questions that extend beyond the facts of the case.
Right.
And those questions, those lingering thoughts are often like the most intriguing ones.
Yeah.
Because they can spark further discussion and debate.
Yeah.
And even lead to changes in the law.
Or in the industry.
Or in industry practices, exactly.
Absolutely. And that's what makes exploring these legal cases so fascinating.
It is.
They're not just like dusty old precedents.
No.
They're windows into broader societal issues.
For sure.
Evolving conversations about fairness responsibility and that constant push and pull
right.
between individual rights
uh-huh.
and business interests.
Well said. It seems like Mrs. Dautre's beauty shop mishap has
yeah.
given us a lot to think about.
Even decades later.
Even decades later.
This whole discussion about informed consent
yeah.
and consumer protection in the beauty industry,
mm-hmm.
it's making me think about something else that's been gaining traction.
Okay.
Yeah, building the right to be ugly.
Ah, yes. The right to be ugly.
Yeah.
It's a very provocative phrase,
you
isn't
it? It is.
But it really gets to some important questions
yeah.
about beauty standards. And the pressures we all face to kind of conform.
To a certain look.
To a certain look.
Yeah. I'll admit, it's not a phrase I hear every day.
Right.
What exactly does it mean?
Well, it's about challenging that idea.
Okay.
That there's one narrow definition of beauty.
Okay.
That we should all strive for.
Right.
It's about embracing individuality.
Okay.
Accepting ourselves as we are.
Mm-hmm.
Wrinkles, blemishes, and all.
Yeah, it's like saying, hey, beauty is subjective.
Exactly.
And I'm happy with how I look. Thank you very much.
Exactly. And it's about personal autonomy and pushing back against those messages
right.
that tell us we're not good enough.
Like the marketing and stuff.
The marketing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it ties into that informed consent discussion because
okay.
it raises questions about the motivations
okay.
behind why people seek out certain beauty treatments.
Right. Are we making choices freely and for ourselves? Or are we feeling pressured by societal expectations?
Exactly. Are we trying to achieve our own vision of beauty, or are we chasing someone else's ideal?
That's a good point. Is getting that Botox injection, that chemical peel,
right.
that hair transplant, is that truly a personal choice?
Yeah.
Or
is it influenced by this desire to fit in?
Yeah.
Achieve a look that society deems more desirable.
Right. And if those external pressures are influencing our choices.
Right.
Are we truly giving informed consent, even if we sign a waiver?
That's the question.
Or verbally agree to a treatment.
Right. Are we fully aware of the risks?
Yeah.
Both physical and psychological.
Right.
When we're constantly being told.
That we need to change.
That we need to change ourselves to be accepted.
That's a really deep question.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if we're really in the driver's seat.
Are we really?
When it comes to our beauty choices.
Yeah.
Or if we're being manipulated.
By those societal norms.
Yeah.
And those marketing campaigns.
Yeah. It's definitely something to think about.
It is.
And it's a conversation that goes way beyond just the legal stuff.
Oh, for sure.
Touching on issues of self-esteem, body image.
Absolutely.
And the power of societal pressures.
It really does.
It really makes you realize that something as simple as a trip to the beauty shop.
Right.
Like we saw in Dautre v. Nick.
Yeah.
Can raise complex questions about personal autonomy.
Yeah.
Informed consent,
mm-hmm.
and our relationship with beauty standards.
And those are questions worth asking.
Yeah.
Both for individuals who are making those choices about their appearance.
Right.
And for society as a whole.
What messages are we sending about beauty?
Exactly.
Whose interests are being served by these narrow definitions of beauty?
Yeah. And how can we promote a more inclusive and accepting view of beauty
yeah.
that celebrates diversity?
Rather than conformity.
Rather than conformity.
Well said. So, as we wrap up our deep dive into Dautre v. Nick.
Yes.
We journeyed from a 1960s beauty shop mishap.
We did.
To a discussion about the evolving nature of negligence law.
We did.
The complexities of legal procedures. And even these philosophical ideas about beauty standards.
Yes.
And personal autonomy.
It's amazing how one case.
I know.
Can spark such a wide-ranging conversation.
It really is. And it's a reminder that legal precedents, they don't exist in a vacuum.
They don't.
They reflect societal values, influence how we think about broader issues, and can even spark movements for change.
They can.
Dutra v. Neck might be a case from the past, but its ripples, they continue to reach us today.
They do.
Prompting us to question assumptions, challenge norms, and strive for a more just and equitable society.
Couldn't agree more. And for those of you who want to kind of explore this case further,
yeah,
I encourage you to look up Dutra v. Neck.
Yeah.
Read that full court decision.
Fascinating.
It's a legal gem.
Yeah.
That offers insights into how courts grapple with those complex issues.
And how legal principles evolve.
And how legal principles evolve over time.
And for those who are intrigued by these deeper questions.
Yes.
About beauty standards, informed consent, and the right to be ugly.
Yes.
I encourage you to delve into those topics as well.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of thought-provoking material out there waiting to be discovered.
There is.
So until our next deep dive.
Yes.
Keep those legal minds engaged.
Keep thinking.
And those critical thinking skills sharp.
Yes.
There's always something new to learn and explore in this fascinating world of law.
Absolutely.
And remember, whether you're navigating a legal case, making a personal decision,
right,
or simply observing the world around you.
Yeah.
Always stay curious. Stay informed.
Yes.
And keep asking those tough questions.
Yeah.
That's how we learn and grow.
That's how we grow.
And make the world a little bit better, one deep dive at a time.
One deep dive at a time.